Possession crucial from this. How much longer will the referee allow? Dublin lead by a point. And there's the whistle. It's over. It's over.
We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road, and that's not going to be taken away from us.
But what I love in hurling, I love players that never give in.
He hits it. He hits it. What? It's over the bar.
This week's RTE GA podcast wants you to look deep into its navel. How are we all doing? And welcome along to the RTE GA podcast. I'm Mikey Safford, and today I am joined in clockwise on my screen, Paul Rouse, UCD history lecturer, professor. Paul, correct me if I'm wrong. Which are you, lecturer or professor? I don't want to sell you short.
Both. I'm both, Mikey, but I really don't mind.
I know you don't mind, but I like to be exact. You're exact, so I should be exact. Rory O'Neill, general RTE sport dog's body. No, so that's not his title. He's the producer for Sunday Game. Conan Doherty, Sportso, Joe.ie, Maximum Media. Conan's another man whose title changes regularly, so I'm not going to attempt it either. Conan,
professor will do, Mikey.
Professor Conan Doherty, and Malachy Kirkin of the Irish Times, who doesn't have a title, I don't think. Do you, Malachy?
Never changes, no. I do plenty of lecturing, though.
All right, Malachy's like a one name. He's like Beyonce. It's just Malachy.
That's it, yeah.
Okay, oh God, there's an image in my head that's not going to go away. Welcome along, gents. We are going to have a conversation about the GAA and the media and where that relationship came from, is now, and more interestingly, in a post-COVID or mid-COVID world, where it is going to go. So there's a lot to dig into, and we will do our living best to not make this a navel-gazing exercise. We really want to talk about how the public has consumed and learned about the GAA, what they expect to learn from the GAA, from the media, and whether the media has a future in, you know, informing the public about what's going on in the GAA. Whenever I have him on, I tend to start with Paul Rouse because he's usually the most informed person in the room.
Oh, God, that's we're all in a lot of trouble.
Set me up for a fall.
Well, I've read some of your books and I have learned from them that the media, the print media, obviously, because that's what existed in the late 1800s, played a critical role in the formation of GAA because it obviously informed people of the GAA's existence and about the meetings that were happening and the first matches that happened. You might give us a potted history beyond that of kind of how central a role the media played in kind of the growth of the GAA, both at home and abroad.
Well, it goes well beyond even recording meetings. The basic fact is that there was agreement that there were at least seven men, though probably only seven men at the first meeting of the GAA, and three of them were journalists. And they were instrumental. Michael Cusick himself was a journalist, as well as running a school. And I suppose it set the tone for how things would go, that in their reports of what happened at the meeting, they entirely disagreed, even to the number of people who were present. There may have been up to 14 present there, but what that tells you is that at the end of the 19th century, there was a massive explosion in the second half of the 19th century in local newspapers. So there, and the development of a genuinely national press. And the story of the GAA through the 1880s, 1890s, and into the 1900s is one that is recorded in newspapers all around the place. And this is a perfect marriage between print and sport, a marriage of review and preview, a marriage of stars, writing about stars, as we all know, journalists are stars, and this thing worked together to kind of create a sense of momentum around the GAA. Now, the GAA itself was disillusioned with the contribution of journalists very often, and on various occasions set up its own newspaper.
Not much has changed.
It's
100 years.
Exactly. Yeah. And it set up its own way of publicising its things. And the print media kept going. Now, we said in the 20s when radio came along that radio would kill newspapers, and that the GAA was right there in the beginning of 1926. The first live broadcast of sport in the country was a hurling match between Galway and Kilkenny from Croke Park, and it was considered an extraordinary feat to have managed to broadcast that at all. And so radio created a new stardom around the GAA, a new sense of celebrity around players in the 30s and 40s and into the 50s. And then that was again added to by a new layer with TV coming in the 60s. And so everyone said at the time, TV is going to displace radio. And then you're left then with not displacement. What you're left with is an accretion of different sources of media, all of which feed into the GAA landscape and which bring us through to the modern times. And that's my history piece done. So I'm gone now. Thanks very much.
Rory, I'll go to you next because you work for, you know, the TV side of things, which is, I suppose, kind of would you say the main kind of medium by which GA is consumed now? It's certainly in terms of how matches are enjoyed, you know.
Yeah, it still is, I suppose. There was a fear when the internet came along that, like, no, not too dissimilar to maybe the fear that existed when, for newspapers, when radio came along. When the internet arrived, there was a fear that television and the consuming of sports via TV would be damaged or be some way supplanted by the onset of the online presence. But while that's certainly fragmented, television is still, the All-Ireland final hurling and football will still be either the most watched or the second most watched, invariably after the Toy Show programme, full stop, every single year. And that doesn't change. The semi-finals in both hurling and football, all four of them, would regularly be in the top 10. You're talking upwards of 800,000-900,000 people, maybe 70%, 60-70% of a share, which is effectively, you know, like, you're kind of almost asking the question, who wasn't watching, you know, as opposed to who was. So it still is. It would still be, like, and I suppose the one benefit that TV has, I suppose, more that, where the online platform presence hasn't been able to penetrate, is it's just one of those, it's the medium that you can still, everybody can gather around and watch, and you can't series link the match, you can't series link the All-Ireland final, you can't delay watch it, and you know, so you have to really watch these events as they happen live. And I think as long as that is the case, I think there will always be a place for television. How the television evolves and the different platforms that it ends up going on to. We often hear people say, why don't the GAA set one up themselves? It's an absolute nonsense. Because why would you do that? Because the first thing you're going to have to do in that scenario is you're going to have to renege the broadcasting rights fee, which you renegotiate, which is effectively a check you get for nothing. Well, I wouldn't say for nothing, but that's the first thing that goes. Then you've got to factor in all your production costs on top of it. Then you've got to factor in all of your, you've got to figure out a way to actually monetize it, where right now they can freelance that out to a broadcasting company and get a huge check in for effectively no real work.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean there will be other, you know, like whether or not the Googles or the Fae or, you know, these types of companies come in, Amazon Primes, and they've already started to look at live sports, whether or not the GAA is something that they'd be interested in, given the size of the market is a moot point. But I mean, I'd be very interested in hearing the lads' views on that. Yeah. But so I suppose TV, I think, will always be there because, you know, it's like we've seen it in the pandemic, certainly with Sky, and how important it was for the Premier League to get back up and running in terms of the finance behind it, and how critical that is to the actual survival of the sport now at the elite level in soccer, particularly in England. So it's always going to be there, but I suppose it will evolve, and the platforms upon which we consume it will probably mutate as well.
Yeah,
to borrow a virus expression.
I'll come to Conan in a minute on how kind of consumption is changing. But Malachy, you're a young man, but you're probably
very around, young, yeah, very young, Mikey. Yeah,
you're probably around long enough to remember when the GAA had not an image problem, but it wasn't particularly cool, and it wasn't
bogger sport.
It was, yeah, you know, and things began to change, you know, slowly. I was Rule 42 helped, and like various things that kind of got to modernize the GAA. I was wondering, how has the coverage of it, both in print, radio, TV, in your opinion, changed in the last 15, 20 years?
Do you know what's interesting, Mikey? And it's pure coincidence that we're doing this today. Today is the 25th anniversary of Clare's Munster final win in 1995. And I was reading, Kieran Shannon wrote a great column in The Examiner yesterday about it. And told me something I didn't know was that that Munster final wasn't live on TV. It was shown on a delay. It was shown at 6 o'clock that evening, which was how it was done in the earlier days of live transmissions, or you know, as live. And that struck a real chord with me because I realised that as a 16-year-old boy in Monaghan, as I was at the time, the Clare thing completely passed me by. Because there was no hurling up where I was from, and the interest in the Munster hurling final that wasn't live on television would have been exceedingly minimal. Genuine. And I was thinking about it as I was reading it, and I realized that I would say I didn't really become aware or interested in that whole Clare phenomenon, which is, you know, one of the five biggest stories of the GAA of the last 25 years. I would say I had moved to Dublin and would have been 1998 before I would have known what Davy Fitzgerald looked like, or I didn't know Loughnane, all right, but you know, Johnny McMahon could walk down the street and sit beside me and I wouldn't have known, you know, who that was. And it really, when I was reading that yesterday, I was going, that couldn't happen now. That, you know, and I know we talk a lot about, you know, the helmets and GA stars becoming, you know, because they're not these big personalities and, you know, that they're not well as well known as they should be. And all of that is true. But a 16-year-old in Monaghan now knew that it was a big deal for Limerick to win their All-Ireland a couple of years ago, knew that it was a big deal for Galway to win their All-Ireland a couple of years ago. And that, you know, that might not be a huge thing, or it might not sound a huge thing to say people in the hurling heartlands all across the country, but that is a direct consequence of the greater coverage, the expansion of coverage over what is it like, literally a generation, like 25 years. It's a totally different landscape now. It has loads of flaws and loads of problems and loads of access issues and all of that kind of stuff. But on that basic level of exposure, how the GAA have expanded their media profile over those years, it's been a riotous success.
Yeah.
Could I add something into that? That's a really well-made point. And 1995 is a key year in this because, of course, it's the Guinness All-Ireland Hurling Championships and the marketing of the GAA was transformed.
Not men, but giants and Slater's crashing into houses and all this.
Exactly. That really matters in terms of changing the profile and the reach of where it went and how other companies took this product that they were now using to sell their brand and in the process change the nature of the GAA brand.
That brings us quite neatly on to kind of, as you say, the expanding media market and to kind of, Conan, you work for a company, one I used to work for as well, Maximum Media. Didn't exist in 1995 because the internet was, you know, your Yahoo email account and dial-up connection and all that. You know, the internet didn't exist in 1995 for all intents and purposes. And also the GAA hadn't been, you know, kind of commercially exploited in a positive sense the way it is now, whereas you work for a company who is built on advertising campaigns, social media, and, you know, widespread broadband access, which obviously didn't exist in 1995. With all that in mind, do you still think television is the most important medium when it comes to the GAA?
Absolutely. Like, you know, you only need Joe Brawley to say one thing on RT or on Air Sport, as it is now, you know.
Not on RT anymore, Conor.
I know. Yeah. But like, then the whole country's gone into meltdown. You can't compete with what somebody says on Sunday Game with what you can stick out on Twitter, for example. I think one of the things that you were wondering, Mikey, like, about how consumption has changed. I don't know if consumption has changed really as much as the platforms. They're more platforms, simply. Like, and I think one of the things that you and I have both learned over the years is people still want good stuff. Like, you know, we've tried a lot of things down through the years, especially on digital media, but the only thing that we know that works is good content. Like, you know, so we always thought we found a trick and we thought we found a new way of getting through to people, but actually the only differentiator was always good stuff. And like, you know, sometimes I think people fall into a trap of calling something digital friendly, or, you know, or putting something out for digital. But, you know, again, we've done like 3,000 more articles that become the biggest piece that weekend. And I think with the platforms, it's probably just a case of trying to learn how to use each platform. And again, it's something that we've been guilty of a lot is, you know, if you're on Facebook and you're just constantly trying to drag people away from Facebook over to your website, and it's like, people aren't on Facebook to be dragged over to your website. They're on Facebook to sort of engage with that community when they go on Twitter. Now, yes, it can be used to flag some things, but, you know, going to Snapchat, all these different platforms that are now emerging, is how are you going to use them now to put out your story? And that's one of the things that I always say to the team. Even if it's something as simple as a picture, what we're still doing is storytelling. That's what we're always trying to do. Like, you know, so how do you put that across in a picture? How do you sell this video? How do you tweet something in whatever amount of characters? How are you still storytelling with that amount, just so you can continue to use those platforms without having to drag people off those platforms? And again, to come back to the digital friendly thing, I think the biggest challenge for digital media, and I always say to people who are coming through, is you still have an establishment, you still have a tradition of the best journalists. Like, you know, so for example, if you're going to buy a newspaper, like that's an event. People sit down to read the newspaper and they're going to read your thing. When you're on digital, it's not taken for granted that they're going to read what you're putting up there. You're actually competing for their attention. And that's not to say that people have short attention span. It's just to say that they haven't put that time aside to sit down and read your piece. It's you're on Twitter and there's so many other options that they can do. So you're trying to catch them in that moment. So it's what can you offer differently? And again, like the one piece of advice that I give to people is when you go to the Aviva or the Crew Park, how many press seats are there? And this is just for written press, hundreds. And like every single journalist is there covering.
Not anymore, Conor.
Not anymore. Yeah. Well, that would be helpful actually for a lot of new people coming through. But you're all there covering the same game, and it's like, again, why would somebody read my match report instead of Maliki's, for example? And I say Maliki as the one. Maliki.
And like, it's just maybe I'll start putting Beyonce on it, but I'll give him a reason.
And like, you know, again, so you're just having to try and think now, what can I offer that's maybe a little bit different? And I think that's maybe the role that digital has played, because you don't want to be competing with people who are more established.
One thing we this kind of comes back to the point Donal Ogue made last week. One thing we used to do at Sports Show, kind of when we were both there, is we used to try and bring something down to like the lowest, you know, the small level, let the individual identify, you know. So, you know, people look down on things like listicles, you know, the 10 kind of guys you see at GA training, etc., etc. But it was a way of kind of connecting, you know, with a younger audience and with people who are interested in GA, who, as you said, they might read Maliki's match report, but they might be looking for something different. It kind of got me thinking about Donal Ogue and his point that on the podcast last week, he kind of said the Club v County thing was a media construction. And it made me wonder, Paul, I'll come to you on this. Do you think the modern GA media does focus too much on the 2%, as we call them? And is that materially different from how the GA media used to behave, or has it always focused on the elite players, the elite games, or did it used to be more community focused?
Again, it depends on which media organization you're talking about, what time of the year it is, and what they're covering. So a national newspaper would obviously have covered national stories much more than it would have covered local stories. But I would disagree with the idea that the Club v County thing is a media construct. I think when you're left with that argument, you're grasping a little bit. To put it at the hand of the media.
I suppose just on that though, Paul, I suppose, and I'm not speaking for Donal Ogue on this, I suppose, like, but just to kind of to surmise the interpretation of what I was in, of what I took from what he was saying, is that I suppose, and I can only sort of give you an example from my own experience. I mean, if you look at, we'll say in Dublin, and I know Conan plays with Skerries and they're senior one, right, which is, you know, a very good level in Dublin. But now, in Senior One, the vast majority of the players that are drawn from the Dublin Senior Football Panel would all be Division One teams. So there's, but there's only 16 of those, and there's 100 clubs in Dublin. So the club versus county argument for 85 clubs doesn't register because no one cares. And I think that's the point that I think he was trying to make, in that it's only affected, like, this club versus county thing only affects a really, really small percentage of clubs and a very small percentage of players as well. And that it's something that the media had focused in on, and not, and it's not very representative of the ordinary everyday issues that most clubs are dealing with. For instance, from, we'd say, my own club, they're really upset. They're only getting 3 championship matches for the whole year. They have to pay their membership for that, and they're all upset about that. They couldn't care less about a club versus county row. Do you follow me?
But you're okay. So that's a different context than I had understood it to be. But allowing for that, you've answered the question yourself there, Rory, because the calendar is intimately linked into this club v county argument, and the nature of when things are played and when they're being squeezed together and when they're being run properly in terms of meaningful matches. So because of its impact on the on the club calendar, the club v county thing is very real, and it's made real in fixtures. And fixtures remain, and we're not going to go down the rabbit hole of fixtures here, because we'll never get back out of it. But that's, to me, that logic just breaks down, and your logic breaks down when you come to the fact of fixtures. Mm-hmm. But rather than creating this as a club v county thing, if you look at representations of the GAA within the media, it is undeniably the case that it is the elite player, the star player, the celebrity player that attracts the attention and attracts the stories for much of the year. And to suggest otherwise just doesn't hold water. What you do get...
Well, Malachy did suggest otherwise and got into lots of... Malachy did suggest otherwise and got into lots of trouble for it.
No. I want to clarify what I've said, though, before I finish. I think for a lot of the players, I think for a lot of people, that is what draws people to it. But it is not just what draws people to it, because Cullen's point is a really good one. A good story is a good story. Mm. And this divide between club and county, it doesn't help the making of a good story. What the point I'm making is about one of that elite group of players who are pushed out at the events which are supposed to attract people to matches, and people are meant to turn up to games, drawn to see people who appeared at press conferences, which seemed to me to be little more than push and shoves.
Malachy, what you did write, and I was going to bring it up, was you when this flared up last year at the more traditional time of, you know, late winter, early spring, which is when the GAA should have its rows, not in high summer. You wrote a very, 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 it shouldn't have been provocative, but it was provocative because you said
much misunderstood.
Careful what you wish for. I go to a lot more club matches than most. You really want to replace you? Do you want to supplant the intercounty elite game from the height of summer and replace it with club games, which are, as it was always my argument, they're of interest to two parishes most of the time, these matches. It was a
some
fair
of them
point.
Half parishes.
Yeah, it was a fair point, very well made, and you were run out of town by a baying mob with forks.
Stop. Everybody likes me. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, but in fairness, you don't cover Leinster Senior League matches, but you just said yourself before we came on air, you'll probably go to Parnell Park in the next couple of weeks for a group match in the Dublin Championship. You know, the GAA, the lower levels of the GAA do get, well, the GAA in general gets, you know, more coverage than other sports in Ireland. I don't think anyone can deny that. But the lower levels of GAA in comparison to the lower levels of rugby or soccer, its nearest competitors, it blows them out of the water, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does to an extent. And look, you can get very deep in the weeds with all of this stuff. There's a way to simplify these things on a very simple level. You know, the market for GAA stories is fragmented before you even type a word. The GAA is 32 counties. There are some very
worldly people in all of those counties who take an interest in the game as a whole, and you know, the people in Donegal who will read a piece about the Waterford Hurlers. But there's not a lot of people in Donegal who will read a piece about the Waterford Hurlers. And I'm talking about, you know, your Austin Gleasons, you know, the top guys. Breaking that down even further, the amount of people in Donegal who will read about Mount Sion are, you know, breaking, you know, getting down into a granular way of talking, is even fewer. Now, Paul is 100% right. And I think, you
stop
know...
Stop there, Malachy. Finish the sentence there.
I think that this is in general the way that I approach working. I would much rather, and have many's the time, written a 2,000-word piece on some obscure hurler, club hurler, with a good story. I would much rather do that than go to a Dublin press conference and write 800 words for the next day. Like, that's a far more enjoyable use of my time. And to be fair to the Irish Times, it is the side that we tend to come down on, you know, if given the choice. But the thing is, you know, our responsibility as a news organization is not to the GAA. It's not to the club game. It's not to the county game. It's not to any. It's we don't have that responsibility. You guys may, on a certain level, as rights holders and as a public service broadcaster, that's a different story. But as a commercial entity news organization, our only responsibility is to the readers, and is to give them something that they'll find interesting. And it is a basic fact of life that more people are interested in the inter-county scene than are interested in the granular level club stuff from their other counties. Like, and Mikey, yeah, you're right. Next weekend, I will go to see, I think,
go watch probably. Scaries. They've got a really industrious wing forward, I've heard, who never ventures beyond halfway, I think.
Well, tell me what the press facilities are going to be like before I go there. But no, I will almost certainly go to Parnell Park for Kilmacud playing Ballyboden in the first round of the Dublin Hurling Championship. Not because all of a sudden the Irish Times has a huge interest in the Dublin Hurling Championship, but because it is the great reawakening. And it will be like, we may or may not carry the scoreline on the piece that I write. Like, it will be about the novelty of being at a game again. I already know what I'm going to, the sort of thing I'm going to write before I go. But I'm not going to give a hostage to fortune, but I would be very surprised if I'm at a club game anywhere the following week, because okay, the games are returning now, and you know, the height of summer would be our traditional time for the GAA stuff to carry the paper. But, whew, like, I don't know if there's that broad interest. There's the interest in everything getting going again. There's the interest in us coming out of the pandemic, finding normality in life again. But that's the story. If I go, you know, I don't know if, whoever, Clontarf against Bridget's the following week, really, is there, like, who are you getting to read that? And my not worry, but my hesitation, and I say I share this with the boss, although I haven't really spoken to him about it yet, but the hesitation would be that, are you going out to cover these games just because they're there? And if that's the case, is that really a good use of resources? Because, like, with the best will in the world, how broad is that the audience? How much is the audience dying to know about the first round of the Dublin Hurling Championship? You know, like, you're talking about a very small constituency there. And I think, and in general, we tend to think that our resources are better used elsewhere, our very limited resources.
Something can matter
better
deeply.
Used another way.
Yeah, something can matter deeply to a small number of people, but it doesn't make it national news. I think that's always been the case.
Totally.
Yeah. So what people do care about is inter-county. Before we get on to the Great Awakening, because I think that's interesting, what is going to happen? Conan, how frustrating do you find covering the Intercounty game? Without turning this into a journalistic moan, but as you said, good content is what people want. How difficult is it to get good content, create good content from the Intercounty game outside of the four lines, shall we say?
I mean, yeah, it's difficult to get interviews, but like there's loads of stuff that you could talk about. Even like Malachi makes a good point there about going to a game and the piece is the event. It's not the game. Like you could write whatever amount of words you want about driving down to the match or whatever. Like, you know, so it's again just thinking of different ways to do it. And I always find it interesting, like the way you're describing covering club matches there, Malachi. Sometimes I think that's what the media have done. I'm sorry, Mike, you don't want to drag us back in, but when we talk about the 2% of the intercounty players, it's almost like the media are covering something that only affects 2% of the people on the island. Yes, that's 2% people who play, but like, you know, 1.1 million people watch the All-Ireland final on RT. Like, you know, yeah. Like that's not, it's like, you know, to suggest that we're not representing the masses by covering the intercounty game is madness, I think. And I actually think the biggest gripe that club players have is that the season probably goes on too long, if anything. Like, you know, it's like you're playing games in November and stuff like that, whereas you were told you're playing at this time. Like, nobody's complaining. And this is where I think the media are just a little bit off at the minute. Not to say that I'm part of the media, I'm certainly starting to sound like a Scaries player here. The media have got it all wrong. But yeah, they're just a little bit off with this one, because I haven't heard anybody complaining about this short window of 12 weeks, because actually it's just excitement. It's like, oh my god, we're going in, we're playing championship and we're done, anything can happen. And there's actually a lot of players that are coming out of retirement and stuff just because they know like what's happening, they know where they stand. It's the 12 month seasons that are the problem. But they bring it back to your actual question. I mean, I think with the intercounty game, because there's that much interest in it, and because like everybody is like, you know, I've never seen Offaly covered as much, for example, as when Paul took over. And if that was an Offaly club team, you know, again, you're just not going to get that interest. But like, that's the aspiration. Everybody wants to be at that level. And it is, I suppose, if we're talking about Donal O'Loghlin's point, like you're talking about the Premier League, that's what everyone's watching, because that's the highest level, that's the elite. So I think if you're struggling for content around it, then like, you might be in the wrong game. Yes, it is very frustrating though, interview-wise, but maybe just have a look around. There'll be other pieces to come up.
There is practical issues for the likes of you, Rory, though, isn't there, with dummy teams, huge, with managers not wanting to talk after match, and people get confused and think this is, you know, TV producer moans because his job's made difficult. But in the end, it is about, again, coming back to what the viewer gets and the content they enjoy, and nobody likes to be given the wrong information or not have an issue after a match explained to them if an interviewee isn't available, etc., etc.
Yeah, and there is the game's promotional aspect as well. I think the proliferation of TV coverage, to go back to what Malachy was saying earlier on, over the last 25 years, has glamorized Gaelic games in an almost stratospheric sense. It's made huge commercial opportunities for a lot of the players. It has made them into stars nationally and locally, and it has It has, by and large, been a fairly positive influence, I'd argue. Now, where you're running into trouble is, I'm not entirely sure if the players see it that way themselves, like maybe until after their careers are finished. For instance, the 2014 All-Ireland final, and I always remember this, I started producing the Sunday Game Highlights programme in 2013. And one of the first things I did was around the semi-finals, particularly just the semi-finals, I turned the post-match interviews, because we usually had a couple of extra high-motion, super-slow cameras on those games. So I created a sort of a feature out of the post-match interviews, whereby you intercut retelling of the story of the game to a certain extent, ask the reporters for longer interviews with the main protagonists, both camps, winning and losing, and then drop a little bit of, you know, dramatic music, lovely shots. One fantastic one there, I always remember, was the Limerick one, Limerick against Kilkenny, because it was played in Lashin's brain. Mm-hmm. The shots were just amazing, and it was just an epic contest. But the 2014 final, right? Now, I would still argue it's the greatest All-Ireland hurling final of all time. You know, for me anyway, it's case closed. The drawn final. Nobody, no one
came out and spoke to us afterwards. Not one player, not one single player from the winning or losing camps. Now, to my mind, that was a sin, because this was an incredible marketing opportunity for the game of hurling, where the main protagonists and the heroes of the story had just taken part in this extraordinary duel, this combat game that was had the most unbelievable conclusion to it, with Hawkeye and everything else. And nobody came out to sell it, you know? Like, in hurling, you always have to be on the sell. You always, because it's such a difficult and a delicate entity. And I remember I did the All-Star Awards, produced them that winter as well. And I remember being in we'd have a pre-production with the GA would be there, the GPA would be there, broadcasters, convention center would have people, a lot of stakeholders in and around the production of the All-Star show. And I made this point in the room, you know, like, would be nice, because I made it sort of in a flippant and slightly sarcastic way, which probably didn't help me.
Wouldn't be like you, Roy.
No, I wouldn't. Right? And I said, you know, well, it will be interesting, I said, to actually hear from some of these players, considering none of them spoke to us after the All-Ireland final. And I got into it. And I remember the GPA person that was there will remain nameless. He's no longer with the organization anyway, so it doesn't matter. But the GPA person that was there at the time said, it's not their responsibility to go out and talk to you. Their only responsibility is to win an All-Ireland medal. And it got me thinking, is it? Is that their only responsibility? You know, maybe it is. I mean, I think it's a question worth asking. Personally, I think there's a responsibility that goes with when you don an inter-county jersey, there's a responsibility also, sort of keeper of the flame, you know, that you have to try and do your best as well to sort of market the game and, you know, make sure that, you know, you spread the message, because you are the best salesperson that the sport will ever have. Mm. And I just felt that was a very insular way of looking at it from a GPA perspective, particularly. But maybe there is no responsibility on the players to come out and talk or to do interviews. Paul, and I suppose, to finish the point, what COVID is going to do, it's going to allow them, you know, not do any interviews at all now. They have the perfect excuse.
The 2%, Paul, if we're going to keep using that horrible phrase, sorry, I'm not going to keep doing that, using that horrible phrase. There, you would get a sense, going back in time to some of the great players, they may not have been willing or knowing marketing tools, but they were, because they are the product. Back when we didn't refer to athletes as products, but they would have been, let's call them missionaries instead. That would have been what Rory's talking about happened, whether it happened organically or not. Like, the GA's best selling point was its best players, I suppose, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but it works in different ways for different people. Like, there's Laois won their only ever All-Ireland hurling final championship in 1915, and the week before the game, a reporter from a Dublin weekly newspaper called Sport took the train down to Laois and sat at the kitchen table.
The train to Laois.
The captain of the Laois team. It was a great interview, just really interested. And you would come away, that interview took up nearly the guts of a page, as I remember correctly. It's a couple of years since I read it. But as the journalist said brilliantly at the end, he said, On leaving Mr. Finlay's house, I was convinced that Laois had no chance of winning the All-Ireland the following Sunday. Indeed, it would be quite an achievement for them to gather together a team to play on the weekend. So this is the idea that things have dramatically changed in the reticence of some people to say anything that's provocative to the opposition doesn't really hold water. There were people like that, and there were people who don't care. I know people are sick of awfully people talking about 1982, but the week before that game, Martin Furlong gave an interview in the newspapers in which Martin Furlong explained that Offaly would win and how they were going to win. So there are people, it doesn't matter, is the point that I make. The review, preview thing doesn't matter. And I will be honest, I take your point, Rory. I see why you would want someone to come after the match. I can honestly say that I cannot, at this current moment, think of one meaningful interview that has happened in a post-match scenario in which a player has said something that I've really thought striking. Maybe Kieran Donaghy, when he taunted Joe Brawley a little bit, got a bit of press and publicity, but that's not what I'm talking about.
Johnny Glynn swearing.
Yeah, but I'm talking about genuine insight into a game. And I think it's an overvalued currency in that respect. And in general, I think the entire preview, review scenario around journalism doesn't really do it for me. Like, I like reading the stuff in whatever medium, and Conan's right about this, it doesn't matter what medium it is, it's how good the content is. And I prefer that. I just can't get hung up on whether a manager or players talk before and after a game.
Yeah. Maliki, we all have heard the stories of our GA peers, GA reporting peers of a certain age who got into the dressing room and interviewed a naked Paddy O'Shea. Seems everybody interviewed a naked Paddy O'Shea at some stage. And now we've got to the stage where the likes of you, me and Conan would loiter outside, you know, idling buses in the tunnel underneath Croke Park. And you,
in the hope of spotting someone naked, is that what you're saying?
Or failing that.
I don't have that kind of time when I'm up against deadline, Mikey, I gotta say.
Yeah, you know, we online guys, we don't have deadlines. We can, you know, we can leer before we write. No, but you'd look to catch the eye of a player you maybe interviewed in the last 2 years who may remember you and not think you're the scum of the earth and may stop and talk to you, or as they may, especially after a drawn match, all scurry onto a bus and not talk to you. So things have been sliding in terms of access, and I take Paul's point that a post-match interview, to me, I won't live or die by one. But it'd be interesting to see what the new reality is going to be, because we're not going to be waiting outside buses. We may be waiting in a room, staring at a television screen, and waiting for the image of a player to appear. If we're very lucky, I don't think you're going to be getting that in Dr. Cullen Park. That might have to wait till you get to Park in Queen or Croke Park. Like access, which has been limited for the last 5-10 years, it's going to be non-existent, you'd imagine, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but I mean, there's a freedom to that, isn't there? Like, you know, that we can get away from almost the pretense that it's worth doing in the first place, you know?
I still think, I know what you're saying, Laurie. I still think that, like, I think it depends on the character. I do accept Paul's point, absolutely. And I know what you're saying, Mikey, that it might offer a freedom. But I still think it depends.
To be fair, Rory, nobody
could tell me that they do not want to hear from Davy Fitzgerald after a match.
Sure. But Rory, you know, like, I think you have chosen the wrong example.
Okay.
With the 2014 match, because you're 100% right. Greatest All-Ireland hurling final, certainly the best that I've ever been at. I've only been at them for the last 10 years, but the best, an unimpeachable game. Not added to or subtracted from one scintilla by getting a post-match interview with any of the players. Like, that is a game that stands on its own and will live on its own. Now, when there is an issue in a game, when there is a sending off, or when there is a huge
penalty,
or a dodgy ref call. But not even that, a huge tactical thing that came out of nowhere, you know, let's say when Donegal beat Dublin in 2014, had there been no post-match interviews then you're at it, then you've lost something, okay? Mm. Then even if that thing is Jim Gavin, you know, who, God love him, tried to be as uninteresting and yet succeeded in being the most interesting person.
And Jim McGuinness was quite good at shutting down interviews if he didn't want to do an interview either.
Jim was fine as well. But you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're taking a game like that, okay, there's a post-match interview that's important there. But, you know, the loss of them will not be that keenly felt, I think. Put it this way, Conan made a great point. The story is the story. Yeah. That's, you know, from when you're covering these things, you can fall so easily into a rhythm of just, you know, doing your report, doing it as well as you can, making it as interesting as you can. But you know, you're looking at your watch and you have to get home to the family. You know, whereas if there are restrictions, and there will be once we get back to it, you find your way around them.
Yeah.
you know, you find interesting ways to do these things.
I want to argue against myself for a second here, if I could. The exception I would make to the rule is after the broadcast, and we haven't spoken about this at all, but after the broadcast of ladies Gaelic football or camogie matches, often those interviews are much more open, much more revealing. You tend to get a bit of something about them. And
because they're not liars.
Well,
you're spot on, though. I think you're spot on because they haven't been sort of media trained to say nothing. They've actually they answer questions honestly, and you're right. Like you get.
I was talking to a Dublin women's footballer one time at the Irish Times Sports Woman of the Year Awards. And I said exactly that to him. I said, and these are great. Like, you know, you obviously, you know, you have no media training. And the two of them kind of looked at me and said, oh, we get loads of that, but we couldn't give a shit about
you. Yeah, that's the point. That's the key point. To actually have the courage. I don't understand this. Like, I genuinely don't understand this when people do interviews. And I'm like, like you quoted Donal O'Cusick earlier on. I really admire the fact that he speaks his mind. Mm. He says what he has to say, and whether you agree with him or not, or you disagree with him, so what? It's a point of view, and it's an articulated point of view, and he's entitled to it, as everybody else is entitled to it. Where I have the problem where people sit in their hands and are afraid to dissent, or afraid to speak, or you're somehow ashamed of expressing an opinion which might be thrown back in your face. What are you worried about?
Yeah. We might lose a little bit of access to players, which wasn't really there, and I think most people here are agreeing it's not the most important thing in the world. From the world that you inhabit online, how important is to say a 15 or 16 year old, do you think they even think about the media as a thing? Do they care whether they hear something through Sports Joe, the Irish Times, RTE, or do they think something's more authentic if Joe Canning tweets it himself or it's on his Instagram story, which is what most people in the media fear this happening, you know?
And that's probably like where Rory's point is like the best, where he's talking about these people as heroes, and like at that age group, certainly, like, you know, more people want to hear from Joe Canning than they do from me. The 2014 final, I was thinking, after a draw, I couldn't think of anything more boring I'd like to listen to than somebody come out and just try to play it all down. And especially when there's so much to pick the bones off when you get back into the studio, because they're playing the game in a week's time. But I think, Malky, you made the point there about a flashpoint or an event. And that's where the opportunity is, I think, for players. Like, maybe, I don't think the reader is particularly mad to hear a post-match interview, but for a player, I remember going to Castle Bar and Mayo were playing for Mana, the famous Aidan O'Shea dive. And it was Shea Cullen, I think, got done by him. And I tried to interview Aidan O'Shea afterwards. And actually, I think he was supposed to do an interview with us for the podcast, or I think he had agreed that anyway, but he just said no then afterwards. But that left me in a position where the story of that day was for Mana getting done by a dive. And I had no longer have Aidan O'Shea's sort of point of view or his stance or, you know, any of his thoughts. And I have to write this story. So I went home and I wrote a piece, and I think it was along the lines of someone who dies should get a red card, they're cheating. And that, you know, was sort of, I made it that black and white. I was a bit younger then. And I think, Mike, you dealt with the consequences the week later.
Aidan O'Shea told me to fuck off the next week because I had a Sports Joe mic cover. I was in Castlebar for their game against Kildare.
And I was not going back there.
Very bluntly told me to fuck off, and I kind of thought, fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair cop.
I will.
I remember
and you
that.
Did.
And like completely understand where he's coming from, but also I was thinking, if he had just spoken to me, like, I wouldn't have written my opinion or my, like, you know, black and white facts of it all, or what I thought were facts of it all. I just would have ran his quotes, and that would have been it. So I think it's probably more incumbent on them, and it does them more favors when there is a flashpoint and they're involved in it, to actually just come out and give their side of the story. Like, well, what's the old saying, an empty vacuum will be filled, and boy, I filled it that day.
We'll finish up in a minute because I think we've lost Paul somewhere along the line. Rory, do you have any idea how you're going to do this? Because, like, you sent us on an article there from the Daily Mail about how Sky Sports have done it. And Sky Sports, let's be honest, slightly bigger organisation than RTE, and they've had to completely rip up the rule book on how they cover live sports and have units based in different locations and dealing with social distancing and Graeme Souness's bad broadband. It's going to be a challenge.
Well, the first part, the very first part of the challenge comes to exactly the last thing you just said, which is broadband reliability on broadband. And that's something that we can't really rely on in this country. So in terms of what Sky managed to achieve, simply just wouldn't be possible for us, because they have a broadband infrastructure over there that would be far superior to what we would have. So that would probably rule that possibility out of, like, they're directing games remotely. The director isn't in, like, for instance, who we're playing tonight, Manchester United and Man United and Aston Villa. That game is at Old Trafford, I think. So the director will probably be in London, which is, you know, this is like, all the graphics are put on via a studio which is based in Manchester, and it's permanently based there. Like, it's incredible the technological advances that they have made to try and make sure that this thing runs as smoothly as it possibly can. And that's with a company that signed a £5.1 billion contract deal, and then however many billions on top of that in terms of their production costs. That wouldn't necessarily be applicable to a regional, small public service broadcaster.
That's more or less what you gave the GA, though, isn't it?
Yeah, £5.1 billion. Yeah. £5 billion. it's just so we don't really know. I mean, the reality is, will you be helped to a certain extent by the fact that there won't be as many people at these matches? Yes. It'll open up different areas for you that you can actually host your broadcast. I can't see us building studios, for instance. I think everything is going to have to be done outside. You're exposed to the elements. Irish winters, wind, rain, all affects audio, microphones, electricity, you know. So, like, it's a bit of a minefield. The Germans were the first out of the traps on this with the Bundesliga, as did the Germans were the first usually with everything in life. That's just a rule. But they were the first out with the Bundesliga, and the model that they employed to get the Bundesliga back in May has been sort of rolled out for different countries to follow and employ. But it's just unworkable from our point of view. You're just not going to be. We simply couldn't. You'll have to have your COVID adherence and your protocols and your social distancing. But in terms of the technological side of it, we're just simply not there yet.
Yeah. Are you, Maliki, ready to don your face mask, bring your hand sanitizer and go where needed? Once the intercounty starts up, you've made it quite clear. It's going to be one and go for you in the club. But once intercounty starts, are you looking forward to it? What do you expect at this stage? It's going to be very different. It's going to be a novelty, and it doesn't matter what you do for a living, a bit of novelty is a nice thing.
Well, I mean, I obviously can't wait. You know, finding out what normal people do with their Sundays has been a terrible, terrible thing in my life. Yeah. I was sitting in the garden one day, I think it was kind of the start of June, and like I would have been at a Munster championship game the night before, and maybe another one on the Sunday, and yet here I was weeding the bleeding garden. It was not my idea of a fulfilling life. Look, it's going to be fascinating if it happens. You know, it's
a fair if at this stage. I think
essentially the start of the championship is 4 months away, give or take a few days.
And it's flu season.
But 4 months ago was, let's say, the 9th of March. Cheltenham hadn't even happened 4 months ago. Yeah. So, you know, the distance between here and the start of the championship is vast, considering what has happened in the last 4 months. So I'm still not overly convinced that it will happen. I think they have left themselves, you know, true, and they've been, their calendar is very good, but like they've given, there is no wiggle room in it anywhere. You know, any sort of delays, any sort of problems with any of the teams, a bad weekend of weather, all that sort of stuff is going to knock things on their head a little bit. But yeah, geez, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be fantastic. Like, as you know, as we've been saying all along, you know, the, the story is the story. And like, this is as, you know, there will come a time when we will be back to the normal run of the championship, and, you know, we'll be dragging our heels going to a Leinster football championship game, and you go, oh my God. God, but remember the days when we had to go in masks and fill in our form the night before and all that, carry on. Like, it's going to be so fascinating to do. And I can't wait, you know, to get out and do it. But, you know, getting through it is going to be, it's going to be new every day.
Yeah, it certainly is. Conan, a Christmas All-Ireland final, does that float your boat?
I've honestly never been looking forward to winter as much. Like, I'm sort of at that stage now where I'm not liking the dark nights. You know, when you're younger, you don't really care about it. But now, when the evenings are longer, it does start affecting me. But I can see the whole calendar of GAA from October right up to Christmas, and then sure, it's a new year then that stage. So I started having the thought that we should actually just do this every year, just put the inter-county season just bang there, not to fix the fixtures or anything, just to give me something to look forward to.
See, Malachi, that's how you could have phrased your argument.
Yeah. I live with it for 1 year, but my body clock works at getting to the middle of September, and then sort of freewheeling from there to Christmas. Yeah. Walking around the Irish Times, reminding everybody that this is a rugby newspaper and not to be annoying me until in February.
Right beyond golf piece.
So
it is going to be interesting though, Mal. I mean, I don't know if you read the piece that I sent you. I sent on that.
I did.
In terms of the limitations around who's allowed into these venues. Mm-hmm. I mean, it won't be the case that, you know, every single newspaper organization's like, you know, get to an All-Ireland final, Dublin are playing Mayo, and you might have the Mayo Chronicle will be sending three guys. Like, that probably won't be allowed.
HRI are letting two reporters into race tracks at the moment.
And how is that decided then, Mikey?
It's the guy from PA, and then the other one's on rotation, as far as I know. But it's that strict. I don't know. That was at the beginning. They may have eased that now. I'm not sure. But when I was chatting to them when they first opened up, that was it. Two reporters.
Because I suppose the one thing that you would probably take, I mean, if the GAA's conference last week when they were unveiled the grand plan, whenever it was last Friday week. It was one person per organization. Now, that was we're obviously in the throes of it currently. But if you're to take that as a yardstick, that's probably what you're going to be looking at, you know, further down the line. Like, it won't be the case that, and...
But again,
you might have some people's noses put out a joint on this.
Yeah,
you know?
But you're talking about three or four games there, Rory. Like, the vast majority of games only ever have one per organisation at them anyway.
Mm. Not local, you know,
okay, at the final stage is fair enough.
Probably, yeah. But yeah. All right, lads. We're definitely descending into inside baseball here at this stage.
So yeah.
We will continue in a second. We'll be chatting to one of those nice, chatty women's footballers, Sarah Rowe. She was chatting to Anthony Pine earlier in the week, and that's coming up now in a second.
Oh, holy Moses!
First of all, you know, it's been a tough few months for everybody, really, and particularly for yourself, given that you were, you know, the other side of the world when the pandemic escalated. And I suppose just if I can start by asking, you know, how it's been for you and how you've dealt with the last couple of months.
Yeah, it's been a different time anyway. I've enjoyed, I suppose, the time off mentally and physically. I don't think I've ever had this long of a break and enjoyed the precious time I had with my family. But I went back training with my club team last week, and to be back in a team environment and have that camaraderie with the girls and that community spirit around the club has been amazing. So I've been delighted to be back.
I think, like, when people see Gaelic players particularly going to Australia, you know, they sort of think it's you're living the dream and it's a no-brainer. But it is a massive decision, and it can be a wrench for people as well, you know, with homesickness, etc. So, I mean, did you feel that particularly when COVID-19 started to escalate? Did it sink in a little bit more, given that you were so far away from home?
Yeah, I'm the type of person, I suppose, is I... the way I think is, like, I don't worry about things until they actually nearly hit me in the face. And I think that was the thing with all this. It was like, it was all breaking here at home, and I was on the phone to my parents and they were telling me what was going on. But I, you know, until you see something for yourself, you don't really believe the way it is. So when the season got called off over in Australia and it was kind of like flights are being cancelled and stuff, I was like a bit like, okay, I really better get home now. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, you know, whatever situation I'm left with here, I will, you know, try and make the best out of the situation. I was prepared for either, for it to go either way. But at the end of the day, you really did want to be around your family at times like that, like this. And it's been precious, as I said, to have that time with my family. And it's, you know, made me very grateful to have all that and have all them great people in my life. But yeah, I think I would have been lonely definitely if I was left over in Australia. But I suppose I would have dealt with that if it came my way.
There is an Irish presence at Collingwood, and I think Aisling Sheridan has spoken about, you know, how good you were for her, and I guess it was probably vice versa. You probably helped each other through that period.
Yeah, definitely. I think just trying that scramble to try and get home, we had to like pack up the whole house in like 24 hours. I left half my stuff over there because I couldn't possibly get it home on the plane. And it was so good to have Ash there. And he was unfortunate. The two of us were like, please, can we go on the same flight? At least we'd have each other. But there was no chance of us getting on the same flight with the way things were going. It was just impossible nearly. So, you know, we were just glad when we got home and we landed on Irish soil. We didn't think we'd ever get there. But yeah, it was great to have her there and just to be able to bounce things off.
You touched on it there, just returning to training with the club. I mean, how big has that been? Because I know everybody has really made an effort to stay active in the last couple of months, with, you know, all sorts of 5K runs and times shooting around all over the place. But, you know, just to get back into a group environment, team environment, you know, that must be a great feeling.
Yeah, 100%. It's like, you know, you really miss that side of things. Like, you can train as much as you want on your own, but it's never the same as the way you train when you're with a group of people, and you're pushed that bit harder as well. And like, you know, we might have been doing 5K runs, 10K runs, like anything straight line stuff, but like you're going straight back into like, you know, turning, zigzagging. So it's like completely different type of fitness as well. And, you know, trying to get that match fitness up, whereas, you know, as much and all as you'd have trained really hard over the break, it's not the same as training in a group. And, you know, you see far greater benefits from training with a group of people. And so that's been great to be back. And I suppose to be back with your club as well is just a lovely thing to do, and it's very refreshing because normally you're coming off the back of an inter-county season, you're coming back into your club and you haven't really been there as such, but now you're with them group of players, you're starting with them from the start of the season, you know, you can build that kind of good team culture, and you know, you're going to start with your club and you're going to finish with your club, and you know, we're nothing without our club. So I think to be able to give that time back and to have that sense of community around the place is lovely, and it's really refreshing.
And of course, you're now preparing for a unique championship, you know, an autumn winter championship, so how do you feel about that?
Yeah, looking forward to it. I think I'm just, everyone's very hungry for football, and it, you know, it looks different this year, but with that comes a different opportunity. And you know, a lot of teams are starting at the same level now, and you know, there's not really an advantage to one team as the other. We all have to start the same date, and we all you know, would put in the same amount of work and all that. So like, I think whatever team deals with, I suppose, the setback as such, the best will be the team that comes out on top. So it's important to keep your mind tuned in and all that throughout the next couple of weeks. But yeah, really looking forward to getting back with the county team as well.
Have you sort of had to take stock of your own situation, Sarah, given that, you know, the season may overlap with the Aussie rules pre-season, which probably start around November time? Is that something that you've had to think about now?
Yeah, that will be definitely something I have to think about. But the signing date for AFL isn't, I think it's between the 1st and the 17th of August, so I have a bit of time yet. But it'll start creeping down my neck fairly quickly. But I don't even know if there are a lot of conversations at the moment with people, because everything's so unforeseen. And you know, it's very up in the air as to what the future holds. So for me at the moment, I'm just like, I'll just focus on my club, see, and hopefully that finishes out, and then I'll focus on Mayo, and then, you know, I'll turn my sights to whatever the future holds for me. But at the moment, it's, you know, it's all still very uncertain.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mayo, Peter Lee has sort of aired his view recently that he maybe prefer if players picked one or the other. So again, as you know, Aussie rules or Gaelic football, you know, so that probably might influence your decision, or is that something that you've thought about?
Yeah, I think that's Peter has to do what he thinks is best for Mayo, and what's best for Mayo is best for me. So it just means that, you know, it is more of a decision now going forward. If you can't play the both, it's, you know, you have to kind of weigh out the pros and cons and what's best for you. And I was studying while I was over there as well, and I finished my degree, and I've been working in that. So I did hypnosis, neuro-linguistic programming, and life coaching when I was over there. So I've started working in that since I came home, but there was one or two other areas that I kind of wanted to further study in, but I didn't get to finish the part that I wanted because of COVID. So you know, whether that'll be in any way of an influencing factor for me, I don't know. But I suppose I've started working now in all that at the moment, and I'm creating my own website and stuff. So that's been great to have another focus as well, and not just be focusing on sport at the moment.
Okay. You are a 20 by 20 ambassador. You've played at elite level in soccer, Gaelic football, and Aussie rules. And I guess you're as well placed as anyone to sort of judge if the perception of women's sport has changed, is changing over the last sort of 3 to 5 years particularly. How do you feel generally? Are things getting better? Are they staying the same? Or what do you think?
Yeah, things are definitely getting better. From when I started with Lidl, I think I've been with Lidl now like 5 years maybe as an ambassador. So their consistency has been unbelievable. Like, you know, a lot of people talk about doing things, but not too many people take action on things. But that's the one thing with Lidl and 20 by 20. It's just constant action, action, action. Like, they just want to make things happen, and they put themselves at the forefront to make that happen. And they drive standards all the time in what they're trying to do. And I think that's amazing as well. Like, even this initiative is, it's like, the fact that it's kind of focusing on women as a holistic view, and, like, you know, exercise is good for everyone. It's not just for, you know, your typical athlete. So I think that this campaign is amazing. And the fact that Lidl have a campaign off the back of the 2020 campaign, the Lidl's Moves campaign, where they have resources for people to be able to, you know, tap into throughout the next 21 days and to form a new habit. So I think they have just constantly driven standards, and, you know, pushed the media and pushed all that kind of extra exposure that it really did need in order for, you know, the whole can't see, can't be. It's very true, and it shows younger girls that they're, when they look, that there's actually a pathway as to where they go and how they can get there. And, you know, it's very clear cut now, whereas before it wasn't so clear cut. It was kind of like you're just going with the flow, and, you know, if opportunities arise, great. But now they see opportunities, and I suppose they can work towards that.
Yeah, I mean, there is a clear growth in participation levels and in crowds at, you know, in the ladies football, in the ladies and Camogie's finals, and in soccer and in Aussie rules and across all sports. But in March, the Herald Sun had to disable the comments section on their coverage of women's Aussie rules because there was so many sexist remarks. So when you see things like that, is that just a reminder of how far we still have to go with regards to how the perception of women's sport, how it's covered, and, you know, sort of ignorant views on it that still remain?
Yeah, I think as well with that, like, there's definitely still a bit to go in terms of that. But it's like, you know, the trolls on after men's game as well, and, you know, the keyboard warriors, like, you're probably always going to have that. But obviously, like, some of the stuff that would be said is just completely inappropriate. But I think you know, there's always going to be that small bit. For some reason, Australia just seemed to have had an awful lot of that over the last couple of years. But they're, you know, the women are really standing up and making sure that their voice is heard, and, you know, trying to improve the standard in that. And hopefully it does work.
Have you found that, for instance, GAA is slightly more inclusive than compared to Aussie rules?
it's much of a muchness, really. I suppose being in a professional environment and training in the same facilities as the men and having access to all the same things, you know, you kind of see that as nearly an even playing field. But like you said, there's a bit to go in the perception of it, and you know, to kind of gain that bit more respect, I suppose, around the place. And I suppose that starts from us making sure that the standards rise all the time and that we're working really hard behind the scenes. But like that, we need the push of all these big campaigns like Lidl and 2020 and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I guess then in that sense, you know, although the lockdown has brought the sporting world to a standstill, but it's also created this enormous hunger for sport at all levels. And I guess there's an opportunity to further push the quality and the importance of women's sport over the next, you know, for the rest of the year, given we've been waiting so long to see any action.
Yeah, definitely. There's going to be a big push, I think, over the next couple of months, and it's very important that we all get behind it. And, you know, there's going to be an influx of sport, hopefully, over the next while. So it's going to be a busy few months for everyone. But like you said, like things like this, the initiative for 2020 and Lidl are really helping to just do things behind the scenes when, at the moment, I suppose, there's no real games happening. So they're focusing on a different element of their campaign, which is really refreshing.
I just finally then, Sarah, you know, as I said earlier on, that we've a restructured championship, and you're back at your club and back training, and everybody's straining at the leash to get going. So what are the goals for yourself for the rest of the year?
For me, it's one day at a time. I just like to think of, you know, short-term goals, and I'm just focusing on my club at the moment, and you know, making sure that we have a good culture in the club and that we drive standards going forward. It's our first year up senior. We went from junior to intermediate, now to senior. So we just want to make sure that, you know, we're playing at the highest level possible and that we keep driving standards there. So my biggest focus is, I suppose, I started with my club and I'll finish with my club, and that's my biggest focus at the moment.
Okay, that's great. Sarah, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, holy
Moses! This has been this week's RTGA podcast. Thank you to all my guests. If you're not a subscriber, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to us on YouTube. Watch us on YouTube. You know, say nice things about us in the comment section if you wish. Saturday and Sunday Sport are back again this weekend, of course, and we'll have all the GAA news and opinion pieces and all the other good stuff on the RT website and News Now app this weekend. So I will chat to you again next week. Thanks very much. Goodbye.
Possession crucial from this. How much longer will the referee allow? Dublin lead by a point. And there's the whistle. It's over. It's over.
We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road, and that's not going to be taken away from us.
What I love in hurling, I love players that never give in.
He hits it. It's over the bar.